from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Once you have different races in this country saying it's okay to give preference to our group over another group, then it's all over. We are a society that is prey to exactly the same evils that the founders were trying to avoid.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Charles Murray, author of the new book, Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America. He'll join us a bit later on in the program for an in-depth discussion about facing reality. First up on today's show, John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. As Major League Baseball emerges from the All-Star break this weekend, we take a look at the Black Sox scandal and Ring Lardner, the journalist who helped expose the fact that players were throwing World Series games. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott.
Ring Lardner might not be a household name. Let's tell people up front, why should they know about Ring Lardner? What's special about him?
Lardner was one of the great journalists and sports writers and writers generally of the first part of the 20th century. And he's born and raised in Michigan, which is kind of neat for those of us sitting here at Hillsdale College. But he made his name for himself in Chicago and became a national figure. But there's a nifty story about his baseball writing and corruption with the Black Sox scandal in the year 1919.
So this is a story I don't really want to talk about. I'm a White Sox fan, as people might know, and so this is the World Series. The White Sox, certain players conspired to throw the World Series, a giant scandal. The movie Eight Men Out, people have seen that. This is the Black Sox scandal. Players eventually were suspended from baseball. It was a big, big deal. How did anyone find out about the Black Sox scandal?
So to make a long story short, Ring Lardner broke the story. But as a bit of backdrop here, and I should add, I'm not at all conflicted as a Tigers fan, and it's a great piece of sports history, but it's also a black mark on the history of sports. It's one of the worst, maybe the worst corruption scandal in the history of professional sports, certainly in the United States. And we should recognize, you know, this has always been a problem. I mean, we're still fighting over what the Astros did a few years ago, mm-hmm. and whether those punishments were satisfactory or not, and so on. But sports has always been vulnerable to corruption and gambling. And people who are willing to raise or lower their performance based on the exchange of money and so forth. And baseball was vulnerable, like every sport. Baseball was vulnerable to this from its very earliest days. And there are lots of examples of players throwing games and so forth in the early days of baseball. What made 1919 and the Black Sox scandal special was a few things. First of all, it was the World Series. This mm-hmm. wasn't just an ordinary game. This was the championship. Number two, the White Sox were so heavily favored to win that year. They were playing the Cincinnati Reds, who were an ordinary baseball team. But the White Sox were just a juggernaut. This is one of the greatest baseball teams ever assembled. The World Series was a mismatch. There was no way they were going to lose this game. And so gamblers actually thought, well, there's no way we can fix this, right? This team is so good, you know, but then the unexpected happened, which is that the players went to the gamblers and said, how about we throw the World Series and we'll do it for $100,000. And there were seven or eight of them who did. There's some controversy about who was involved and who was not involved, but clearly a number of them did. And they made this offer to these gambling interests who took it up. And they did indeed throw the World Series. The White Sox lost. They should have won. The Reds won the World Series that year. What Ring Lardner did is he covered the White Sox. This was kind of his beat. He had a national profile. He covered baseball, but he was really a White Sox writer. And he covered them for years. He knew these players personally. And he started hearing rumors about this, and then he started watching the performances at the games. Ring Lardner and Hugh Fullerton, who was a kind of mentor to him, would keep their scorecards, and they would mark every time they thought a funny play happened. You know, a player committed an error that looked like an easy play, this sort of thing. And by the time they were done, they didn't have any evidence of, you know, money changing hands, that they knew there'd been corruption, but they said, just look at this. They said, there's no way this team would perform this badly unless there had been corruption. And then with some further reporting, the whole scandal came out, the truth came out. But there was Ring Lardner right at the center of it, breaking what was certainly the biggest sports story of his year, really of his time, and one that we still talk about today.
When it comes to sports journalism overall, should we look at it differently than a hard news journalist as compared to a sports journalist?
Well, yes and no. On the one hand, you know, sports can seem frivolous. You know, sports don't matter as much as elections or pandemics or technological developments. Maybe they're all it's just entertainment, right? And there's some truth in that. On the one hand, on the other hand, sports are great. People love them. This is a terrific hobby. People enjoy watching them, and they make for great stories, stories of achievement, of failure, of competition, all sorts of things like that. And some very talented writers over the years have devoted themselves to this. You know, Tom Wolfe, one of his very early breakout stories was about NASCAR, about the birth of NASCAR. You know, he went on to great things. The current editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, got his start at the sports section of the Washington Post. So we see great writers devoting themselves to sports. And also, and we can't lose sight of this, sports journalism is a really important part of the commercial enterprise of journalism. If we didn't have sports, there'd be a lot fewer newspapers in America. I mean, they're already struggling. Right. But if you took out the sports sections, a lot more of them would fail. And when people tune into the local news, what do they want? They want news, weather, traffic, sports.
Talking with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale, about Ring Lardner, the journalist. If people do know Lardner, they might not know him for his sports journalism. There's a short story called A Haircut that people might have read. But what's that about?
Haircut is a short story he wrote in the 1920s. This was after the Black Sox scandal, because after the Black Sox scandal, Ring Lardner, who'd been this great sports writer, really got disenchanted with sports. And he's like, I'm done with this. And he left Chicago, he moved to New York, and didn't write about sports a lot. He did a little bit, but really abandoned it and wrote about more general topics for a national audience. He also wrote short stories, and this one, Haircut, is a masterpiece of the form. In fact, if you're going to collect maybe the two dozen greatest American short stories, you're going to get, you know, some Edgar Allan Poe, Nathaniel Hawthorne. This story, Haircut, if it's not on that list, it's certainly a candidate for being on that list. And I won't say much about it except everybody should read it. And it's a great story about violence and man's capacity for evil and a terribly unreliable narrator. So it's a great story to read, and everybody should look at it at least once.
And if we follow the lineage here a bit, Ring Lardner's son also has some prominence, about 20 years or so after the Black Sox scandal.
So there's Ring Lardner Jr., and I have two things to say about that. One is that when Ring Lardner was in his prime writing in Chicago, he was so popular and well-known that a young man, a boy actually, in high school in Chicago at the time, used the pen name Ring Lardner Jr., and that was Ernest Hemingway. That's the byline he used in his high school newspaper. That's how influential Ring Lardner was. Ernest Hemingway, you know, one of the great American writers of the 20th century.
John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, talking about Ring Lardner and also the Black Sox scandal. John, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott. My pleasure.
Up next, Charles Murray, author of the new book, Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Charles Murray. He is Emeritus Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, also author of the brand new book, Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America. You might have read other books he's written, including Losing Ground, The Bell Curve, where he was a co-author, and Coming Apart. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Before we get into some of the data and research in Facing Reality, I wanted to ask, you mentioned early on that the concept of identity politics was one you had, I guess, underestimated is one way to put it. What made you take identity politics seriously?
Last July, basically, Scott, it was after the protests and the riots or the coverage of them, and I was astonished at how completely the New York Times, Washington Post, CBS, NBC, all of the major outlets said, oh, well, this is evidence of racism, and this is validating the identity politics accusation of systemic racism in America. And I kept waiting for them to mention a couple of things that are well established. Nobody who's interested in facts argues about them. And namely, violent crime rates in black neighborhoods are much higher, multiples higher, than they are in white suburban neighborhoods. And wouldn't it make sense that there are going to be a different set of responses to the policing in a highly dangerous neighborhood than one that isn't so dangerous? Just at least mention that. How about the accusations that blacks don't get a fair shake in the American labor market? And I'm thinking to myself, aren't they even going to mention that you have lots of top executives in lots of American corporations that would love to have more blacks represented in the senior ranks of their management, but the pipeline of people qualified to get entry-level jobs for those has a lot more Asians than it does blacks, and the number of blacks qualify isn't nearly big enough to go around. And so even if we have a completely non-racist country, you're going to have lots of corporations that have very few black faces in the senior levels of management. It's not racism. It's a reality of who's coming into the labor force with what qualifications. So having seen that, I said to myself that the mainstream media has bought this. They bought into systemic racism. Later, I realized the Biden administration bought into it, and I'm trying to fight back because identity politics is a direct repudiation of the American creed, the traditional one, which says you're supposed to treat people as individuals.
Let's talk about those two truths about race in America that Facing Reality covers. Let's talk about the data. First, on cognitive ability, Chapter 3, Race Differences in Cognitive Ability, what does the data tell us?
First, let's pare this down to the simplest level, because these subjects, as you know, Scott, are hugely sensitive. Mm-hmm. They are highly inflammatory. So don't worry about whether IQ tests measure intelligence correctly. Don't worry about anything like that. Just say mental test scores, whether they're IQ tests or whether they're tests of achievement in reading and writing that the Department of Education conducts periodically, mm-hmm. show significant differences between blacks, whites, Latinos, and Asians. Differences in such test scores are associated with differences in classroom performance and associated with differences in job performance. This is true for large groups, and I want to emphasize this. Knowing a person's race tells you very little about that individual's ability, virtually nothing. Nothing at all. But if you take large numbers of people, then a difference in means means that a difference in means will appear. And that has social implications for job performance and classroom performance. But I cannot emphasize too much. A difference in means does not sort people into bins. Millions of blacks are smarter than millions of whites.
There's a section of the chapter in which you ask a question that might be on the minds of some listeners. I'll just read it verbatim from the book. How can we expect that an African or Latin child growing up in poverty, going to terrible schools, and victimized by systemic racism will score well on tests designed by white people to measure things that white people have decided are important? What's the answer to that question?
The answer is that the tests, even though that seems like a plausible accusation, doesn't work out that way. And the reason we know it doesn't work out that way is pretty powerful. Namely, the reason that mental tests are used at all for college admissions or used for jobs is because they have what's called predictive validity.
Mm-hmm.
If a test is biased against a group, let's say, suppose that the test is biased against blacks, what that means in the jargon is that it will underpredict black performance, or to put it in more ordinary language, let that person into the job, and the black candidate will perform better on the job than the test score would have predicted. Same thing with admission to a college. Let that black young person in, and they will perform better in college than their SAT score would have predicted. Well, that has been tested time and again with large samples replicated. And the research on this ended about 15, 20 years ago at least, because the answers were so consistent absolutely across the board. The tests do not underpredict black performance. They are just as predictive of black performance and as accurately predictive as white performance. The only caveat to that is that the tests oftentimes overpredict black performance, which means the kids don't do as well in the classroom as the SAT score would have predicted. They don't do as well on the job as their employment test would have predicted. Okay, that's raised a bunch of problems. But that does not indicate that the test is biased against blacks.
Charles Murray is with us. The new book, Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America. Let's tackle the second truth, race differences in violent crime. That's chapter 4 in the book. Charles, again, what does the data tell us?
As I answer that, I want to point out to your listeners, I have posted the actual raw databases that I used for both cognitive ability and for crime on the Encounter Books webpage. And you can download them free of charge, and you don't like my conclusions, go ahead and look at the data and you come up with your own. Okay, with regard to arrest data, I actually do have stuff in there that has not appeared before. In the last few years, the Open Data Initiative has meant that many police departments make available for free download the entire arrest records of their cities, going back in some cases 15 years. And you can download those, and in 13 cities, including New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., the downloadable arrest records include the race of the person arrested. So it's really simple stuff. It's not even statistics. It's just arithmetic. You take the number of blacks arrested relative to the black population in that city, the number of whites arrested for violent offenses relative to the number of whites in that city, and you compute the ratio. And the ratios, well, in New York, the ratio is 11.6 to 1, blacks more than whites. In Los Angeles, it's 9 to 1. Chicago, 14.5 to 1. Washington, D.C., 19.9 to 1. These are very large differences. And they are inarguable. And it's been known for a long time that violent offenses were higher, but we haven't had the data to be as precise as this.
Hold on right there, Charles. We'll come back in just a moment to talk more about the new book, Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America, with Charles Murray. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Summer takes flight at Turtle Bay's Wings of Summer Butterfly Exhibit, open June 19th through August 15th. Experience hundreds of butterflies in a tranquil and enclosed garden. Access is free for Turtle Bay members and included with park admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, We've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Now that our healthcare heroes have helped us cross to the other side of COVID, I'd like to take this time to thank all of our heroes who have kept everything flowing smoothly. From the wonderful teachers at the Redding Rancheria Head Start to the helpful crew at the Wind River Mini Mart, the friendly staff at the Redding Hilton Garden Inn, and the amazing people who make everything at Wind River Resort and Casino and the Redding Rancheria run so smoothly. Thank you. Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
It's July and Black Bear Diner is celebrating red, white, and blue all month. Start your morning with two sweet cream pancakes topped with fresh sliced strawberries, our house-made blueberry topping, and whipped cream. Or finish off your favorite Black Bear Diner meal with our California cheesecake, drizzled with blueberry and strawberry toppings, plus whipped cream. Come visit us at the diner at 2605 Hilltop Drive in Redding, or order at blackbeardiner.com for takeout and delivery.
Black Bear Diner.
Hi, I'm Arielle Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference in a disaster. When disaster strikes, you want to protect your whole family, including your pets. To help keep your family safe and help our best friends in their worst times, find tips at AmericanHumane.org.
Dinorama presents Bruised by the Bridge at Turtle Bay Exploration Park on Friday, August 13th. Join us at the Sundial Bridge for this 21 and over event featuring craft beers, live music, tasty food, and more. Get your tickets today at the Turtle Bay Museum or online at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can find more about Hillsdale College by heading to hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Charles Murray, the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, author of previous books including Coming Apart and Losing Ground, and his new book is entitled Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America. Charles, is there anything outstandingly surprising about what we find in the data, or is it simply giving us a conclusion that many of us don't want to accept?
There's nothing surprising. The differences in cognitive ability have been appearing consistently since the very first representative samples were collected back in the 1960s. They got smaller in cognitive ability during the 1960s and 70s, but they have been unchanging for the last 30 years, despite enormous efforts to, like No Child Left Behind, for example, to bring those differences down. But the point in the book here is not why the differences exist. I want to avoid arguments about the role of the environment versus the role of genes and all that, because that's not really relevant.
Mm-hmm.
What's relevant is the situation that faces us today. That's why I have as my definition of reality, Philip Dick's definition. Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. In the case of cognitive ability, you have lots of people who want to say, oh, it's the legacy of racism or it's bad schools. And once we fix the bad schools or once we do something about the legacy of racism, then they'll go away. Well, you can try to make that argument, but making that argument does not make the current reality go away. Mm. That sticks around no matter what the causes are. In the case of crime, as I said, we've had national statistics pointing to a major black-white difference that go back 50s at least, but the only surprise in here is when you break it down by city, the differences are even larger than we'd realized.
Charles, you mentioned earlier the job market, the labor market. At the end of Chapter 5, you say, hey, the American job market is racially biased. You could call it systemic racism, but you say the American job market discriminates in favor of racial minorities other than Asians. What's the data you looked at that made you come to that conclusion?
In that case, I combined three large nationally representative samples that had excellent test batteries and combined them because they had the same variables. These were longitudinal studies conducted by the Department of Labor in two cases, and the third one was conducted by the Department of Education. In this regard, I took the named occupation of the people who responded to the survey, and I took their test scores, and I calculated the mean test scores for whites, blacks, and Latinos in those cases where you had enough people in an occupation to provide a good sample size. And what you find in every occupation, from low-complexity jobs up to high-complexity jobs, is a substantial difference in the people who are hired. Just to give you, I'm looking at the table of the mean for accountants among whites was 111, 100 for blacks, 104 for Latins. For K-12 teachers, the white mean is 110, 95 for blacks, and 101 for Latins. Now, once again, these are substantial differences, but there is a catch, Scott, in this. They don't need to exist. You can have a difference in the entire population, but if employers say, our job is to give a fair shot to everybody who comes here to interview for a job, and we are going to hire the people who walk in and have evidence based on objective criteria that they can do this job and do it well. If you applied the same criteria to every job applicant as best you could, you would have virtually no difference in these test scores, because you would end up, even though you didn't examine the test scores, you would end up with people with very similar ability to do the job, and the test score differences wouldn't matter. We have brought this problem on ourselves. Aggressive affirmative action inevitably produces these kinds of differences because the relationship between test scores and job performance exists, and you can't make them go away.
Charles Murray with us. Facing Reality is the book, Two Truths About Race in America. As we get toward the back part of the book, some of the conclusions/recommendations, you say you want the book to open a space for policy analysts to incorporate race differences into their analysis. What would that look like?
Well, right now, you have, in social science analysis, you have, let's say, income. And so you compare black mean income and white mean income, and you have this big difference. Well, you want to say, what explains it? Well, there's some natural other things you want to add in. You want to add in occupation, because income varies across occupations, so you want to control for that. You want to control for education. But in addition to controlling for education, you want to control for IQ. Because in education, you have the same kind of aggressive affirmative action you have in the job market, so that people who have bachelor's degrees who are blacks and whites have very different IQs. So if you introduce IQ as another one of those variables, you can get closer to the answer, how much difference is there in black and white incomes after you control for cognitive ability, which is way more informative than the analyses which simply ignore that. If you know that a large difference exists between races, it's an effective tool for identifying the proportion of that disparity that is reasonably attributable to racism. And I would argue that proportion is usually quite small.
Charles, there's a bit of a paradox that you mention in the book, in that you want to return to the ideal of treating people as individuals in this country, and yet the book makes arguments that we treat Americans as groups in some of these factors.
Yeah.
So how do you reconcile that?
I was aware of that paradox all the way through, and it's forced upon us, because as matters stand, the advocates of critical race theory and identity politics say, look at these disparities in income, in education, and then they go through the list of things in which there are big differences between blacks and whites. And they are saying, what else can it be except racism? After decades after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, we still have these disparities. It has to be systemic racism. Well, it doesn't have to be systemic racism. It can be largely attributable to group differences, and we have been afraid to say that. We, meaning people who want to defend the ideal of treating people as individuals. Unless we are willing to bite the bullet and say, okay, you ask, what else can it be except racism? We will give you an answer. You aren't going to like the answer. You'll be angry at it, but it is an important part of the answer. So that was the, either you defend the idea of treating people as individuals and do the kinds of analyses I did, or you just acquiesce to the identity politicians, and I don't want to do that.
As we close, Charles, I want to circle back to the first question that we talked about, this idea of identity politics. Why, in your mind, is identity politics such an existential threat to the American experiment? How can what you put forward in Facing Reality help us?
See, it's an existential threat because it's a direct repudiation of what made America special, the ideal of treating everybody as individuals regardless of race, color, creed, religion, or anything else. But it wouldn't be so bad except that right now you have blacks accusing whites of being irredeemably racist and evil and causing all of blacks' problems. And an awful lot of whites in America are saying, wait a minute, I don't feel like I'm a racist. I haven't behaved as a racist. Mm-hmm. I've had it. And this response, I've had it, I'm afraid, is already starting to take more and more attraction of whites to playing the identity politics game. And once that happens, once you have different races in this country saying it's okay to give preference to our group over another group, then it's all over. We are a society that is prey to exactly the same evils that the founders were trying to avoid.
Charles Murray, the new book, Facing Reality, Two Truths About Race in America. Charles, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we talk with Matthew Gaetano from Hillsdale's History Department about Marsilio Ficino, 15th century philosopher of the Italian Renaissance. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This ad is not from HUD or FHA and was not approved by HUD or any government agency. Consumers remain responsible for property taxes, homeowners insurance, and home maintenance. Rich Pinnell, Branch Manager, NMLS number 1067640, PRMI NMLS 3094.
Medical advances have given us the gift of longevity. It also gives us a moving target when we're planning retirement. Because of this, some people haven't been able to live the lifestyle they're accustomed to. The good news? Reverse mortgages have been refined over the years. This gives us a great multifaceted tool for retirement. You could eliminate your house payment or buy an asset you always wanted without suffering the penalties from cashing in an investment. There are literally hundreds of scenarios, but the end product is you could live your life more comfortably. My name is Rich Pinnell with Primary Residential Mortgage, and I'm a reverse mortgage specialist. I've spent years helping seniors with financial issues solve their problems, and I would like to help you too. You can find me at Primary Residential Mortgage, 530-722-4579, or go to rich4 Reverses.com.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew with this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Today we're sharing Perez Carrillo Trilogy. This gift set is the pinnacle of years tirelessly dedicated to the perfection of cigars. Rating 95, 96, and 98 by Cigar Aficionado, these three cigars have put Ernesto Perez Carrillo at the top of the industry. Come down to the best cigar shop around, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
Redding Electric Utility cares about the whole community, and we offer an income-qualified residential energy discount program that can save you up to $400 a year on your energy bill, and once per year, CARES bill credit up to $300. To find out if your income qualifies you for a residential discount program and CARES program, call 339-7200. That number again is 339-7200.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We welcome one of our new affiliates this week, WDMJ, 1320 AM in Marquette, Michigan, the Upper Peninsula. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Dr. Matthew Gaetano, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College. Dr. Gaetano, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Spending this segment talking about Ficino's revival of Platonism. So before we start, or as we start, who is this guy, Marsilio Ficino?
Yeah, Marsilio Ficino is arguably the greatest philosopher of the 15th century. Certainly, again, with Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, the leading philosopher, one of the leading philosophers of the Italian Renaissance, and does something that I think a lot of students might appreciate but really don't know about, which is to translate all of the Platonic dialogues and a lot of other Platonic materials into Latin for the first time. Right, that for 1,000 years and beyond, the Latin West, the Western Europe, did not really have access to Plato, with just a few exceptions, bits of the Timaeus, and so on. And so this was really a monumental achievement, where Ficino is using that humanist attention to language, the learning of Greek, which was something that very uncommon in the High Middle Ages, to actually make accessible the thought, the writings of Plato, these great dialogues that are such a part of Hillsdale education, you know, Plato's Republic, the Crito, and so on.
So is that what we mean, or what do we mean more largely when we say that he revives Platonism?
No, I think it is his translation effort that's really central to his achievement. I think many historians of the Renaissance tend to focus maybe even too much on him as a humanist, as a scholar, as a teacher of languages and someone learned in those languages, and he was all those things. But he did have broader concerns, right? Like his fellow humanists, was worried about a lack of virtue in, you know, a lot of Western Christians, but especially his fellow Italians in Florence. And he thought, again, this is where he's a bit unusual for a Platonist, again, a bit more metaphysically, theologically ambitious like Pico, that Ficino believed that what we really need is not just, you know, Ciceronian oratory or eloquence, but we need the way in which Plato could inspire us through the love of wisdom to have, at least Ficino believed, much more learned priests, right? So that religious dimension is there for him, and much more pious, kind of religiously inclined philosophers. And so he really wanted to bring philosophy and religion closer together, that if you have learned priests and pious philosophers, they're not identical, but they're definitely pointing in the same direction, right? And so he makes Plato accessible, but he also thought that Plato's way of inspiring in the love of wisdom, not just the love of virtue, though there was that, of course, as well, could really help in the renewal of not only the society that he lived in, but also the church. He dedicated works of ancient Platonists to cardinals and even to a future pope in a particular case. So this is something that is part of this larger story about a renewed attention to Plato during this period.
How is that revival of Plato received by the scholastics more partial to Aristotle through Thomas Aquinas?
Right, so this is something that, you know, several years ago perplexed me, right? Because I think Aquinas is a pretty great theologian, and he makes some pretty decisive critiques of Plato and, you know, the realm of the forms, and just says, no, look, Aristotle shows us that we can, you know, through our experience, come to a scientific understanding of the world around us. And I thought, why would Ficino and maybe Pico and these Renaissance Platonists have rejected that? The more I read them, the more I came to understand that Ficino is part of a much longer tradition that goes back to these late antique, you know, 4th century, 5th century, and beyond Platonists who believed that Plato and Aristotle, while they had some disagreements, they were really on the same side, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And the Neoplatonic curriculum, the Platonist of the 4th, 5th century and so on, the way you would study philosophy, you'd start with Aristotle. And I think Ficino largely held that view. So he wasn't rejecting Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to reintegrate Aristotle into the larger world that Aristotle actually lived in, where his teacher was Plato, and to see the teacher and the student as much closer together. Now, some scholastics were skeptical of some of these works. He's translating these later Platonists like Plotinus and Proclus and these other figures, some of whom made some pretty substantial critiques of, or at least weren't all that interested in Christianity. And so this worried some figures in the 15th and 16th centuries. But, you know, I think that, you know, Ficino really, really believed that this renewal of Platonism could help Christianity, could help Aristotelianism, could help Scholasticism from being so, you know, from his point of view, a little bit cold and logic chopping and a bit more inspiring, and bring about this real renewal. And I think it's worth noting that many of the scholastics of the 16th century, once you have Plato available to you, it's not as if, oh, I will never read him. I mean, if Aquinas had access to Plato, it's hard to imagine that he wouldn't have, you know, taken the chance
mm-hmm.
to have studied that with great care. In fact, there were some rumors that Aquinas was going to be writing a commentary on the one work of Plato, the Timaeus, that was partially available. So Aquinas wasn't contemptuous of this Platonic tradition, and the scholastics of the 16th century were also, you know, very happy to have the Platonic dialogues at their disposal.
So people likely are familiar with the phrase Platonic love, but might not know that Ficino's the one who coined that term. How did that come? Why did he use that term?
Yeah, so the idea of Platonic love, or sometimes he talks about Socratic love, I believe, is coming out of his own pretty early commentary on Plato's Symposium. Right, so I think, you know, this is really also very interesting. I think when we, you know, at least the kind of quick introductions to Plato, right, we think of the realm of the forms and, you know, perhaps the idea of the body as a prison of the soul, and the soul wants to escape to be with the forms and the transcendent order of things. What's really important to know is that the Neoplatonists did not really interpret Plato in this way, and Ficino in the 15th century was very interested in this other side of Socrates or Plato, the Platonic dialogues, which was, you know, these love dialogues, right? Which isn't just an escape from the body, but the way in which, you know, the body and the cosmos and beauty in the world is the beginning of a path of ascent to, for him, the beauty of God,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, you know, Platonic love was, you know, again, not corporeal love. He's not talking about anything kind of fleshly, and partly because for him, we're dealing with, you know, the relationship of teachers and students, all of whom are men, and so on and so forth. And so he's dealing with that whole issue in the Platonic tradition. And, you know, but he is trying to articulate the way in which the beauty, partly of the body, but also of the mind, is a step and a path towards seeing the beauty of the cosmos and ultimately the beauty of the divine itself. And even in that early commentary in the Symposium, which is, you know, very strictly dealing with Platonic materials, mm-hmm. but at the end he does bring in the Holy Spirit, right? That the Holy Spirit is the love between the Father and the Son, right? So he's wanting to even integrate Christian theology in that early commentary of his on the Symposium, where he develops this important idea that really did inspire a lot of poets for the next several decades, if not centuries.
Dr. Matthew Gaetano, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, talking about Ficino's revival of Platonism. Dr. Gaetano, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My pleasure.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John Jane Miller, Director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, telling us a bit about journalist Ring Lardner and the Black Sox scandal. Charles Murray, his new book, Facing Reality. And we heard from Matthew Gaetano from Hillsdale's History Department, diving into the work of Marsilio Ficino. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's the Ramsey Show, where we talk about your life and your money. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
100 years ago, Simpson University began with the promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with the promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Building on our foundational promise to educate ministers and missionaries, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
Hey, Northern California, this is Nigel Skeet. Join me and my friends every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. at the California Adventure District Radio Show, where we talk about all the amazing adventures to be had in our area, from climbing Mount Shasta, hiking the trails, kayaking, overlanding, and camping with Bigfoot. We have it all. California Adventure District. Less people, more adventure. Listen Saturday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m.
As restrictions continue to be lifted in Shasta County, many businesses are set to reopen, and KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and KCNR1460.com wants to help spread the word. So, if you are reopening your business, planning on opening a business for the first time, or are already open for business, KCNR has many advertising packages to choose from. Give us a call at 530-605-4565 and talk to a KCNR representative today. That's 530-605-4565.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and hear us online at KCNR1460.com. Don't miss Armstrong and Getty, plus Ben Shapiro, and Free Fire Radio with Carl and Linda Bott, featuring special guests talking about local issues on KCNR.
Tobacco and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. Tobacco and Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Tobacco and Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
Readers tend to like a character who is at least superficially like themselves, but they quickly lose interest unless this particular character is somehow out of the ordinary. Orson Scott Card.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Happy December.
Yay.
We hope you had a good Thanksgiving and are looking forward to all of the festive holidays that are happening this month. As we do in December, we are doing a Frequently Asked Questions series. So we've taken your questions that you've submitted. We've taken questions that we see commonly when we are in writing forums and other places, questions that we get asked a lot, and trying to answer them here quickly and succinctly so that you know where to go, where to move forward. So what is today's question?
How descriptive are you with characters and landscape appearances? When do you describe them? And what about the sequel? Do you describe them then also?
So let's take this from the beginning. How descriptive do you get with character and landscape appearances?
My answer, as little as possible.
There are different approaches to the idea of describing characters, and it is somewhat genre-specific, but most experienced authors will agree on a couple of things. And one of those is you do not ever give a head-to-toe description just because.
Yeah, it's not often your character is going to stand in front of a mirror and notice the color of their own eyes.
No.
If anything, people tend to be self-critical. They're going to dislike something about themselves unless they're an incredibly vain character.
So it does depend on the character. That's the other thing experienced authors can agree on. It depends on the character, what they notice, and what they would describe. So, when do you describe characters? And this will go into how descriptive you get.
When I am describing any character, it's almost never from that character's point of view. He is noticing her across the room. She is checking somebody out.
It depends on the point of view. But you need to have a specific reason for describing the character in that moment. Think about the last time you met someone. How much about them did you notice? Did you really go full creeper and do a full body scan, taking note of every aspect of their body?
I really hope if you do this, there's some sort of comedic twist at the end. You're looking at her from the back and across the bar, and you see the fantastic stiletto heels that perfectly match the short skirt and the long legs in between, the slender waist you get up to the front. The character turns around and full beard. Or something just completely off the wall. We're like, oh, okay, we're going on a different path here.
Again, that's a specific plot device to use there. Number one, your readers don't want to be overwhelmed with description. It gets boring. And number two, the more vague you are, especially with your main character, the more connected your reader can feel to them.
I would say most of the time, if I'm describing a character, that character is probably going to die in the length of the scene. This is mostly because I don't want to name guard one and guard two, so I'm going to say the fat one and the one with the stupid hair. They aren't going to last long. Not long enough for me to name them, but if they have two different bits of choreography, they need to be differentiated, therefore physical attributes are an easy way to do that.
So another time to describe that goes along with there's a specific reason is if there's something atypical about that character's body. Maybe they're missing an eye. Maybe they have severe scars on their face or some kind of disfigurement that stands out that will catch your main character's eye first.
Again, when your character is noticing something about themselves, it's rarely going to be a positive note. because that's how a lot of people are, especially if your main character at the beginning of your story is going to believe a lie about themselves. I just had a scene where my character caught a glimpse of herself in a mirror, and she immediately turned away because she doesn't like what she sees.
When it comes to your main character's hair color, that kind of stuff, there needs to be a reason for it. So for my main character in my last book, because she likes to dye her hair, she has black hair with emerald highlights. There's a scene where she's kind of messing it up because she has a pixie cut.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.